when we study people that are exceptional at risk taking, there's some clear functions that are, you know, take part. And one of those is that there's a phrase that guides many of them. There's two phrases that guide many of them. One is, you'll do whatever it takes. When something matters to you, you'll do whatever it takes. And if you think about being a mother or a husband or a father or, you know, someone that you deeply love in your family structure and there's a car coming, you would do whatever it took to be able to save that person that you love. And so that level of conviction starts with great clarity. And that clarity is the statement that I love you to as much as you can articulate in words. And I will do in my action whatever it takes.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't signed up for it yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, links to books written by our guests, TED Talks, and all sorts of other cool stuff that we've dug up throughout the week. And not only that, if you're on the Quiver, you'll be able to get access to the introduction to our new book absolutely free. So you can learn more about it by going to unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter. Today's episode is sponsored by HostGator. So every day, most of us are coming up with ideas for creative projects of all sorts, and a lot of them never see the light of day because we don't take any action on them. So my friend James Clear told this story about a reader of his who wanted to lose a bunch of weight. James told him to set the bar really low and make the goal just to drive the gym, not even go in, but just to drive to the gym. And you're probably wondering what the hell this has to do with HostGator. Don't worry, I'm getting there. So eventually he realized that he might as well go in, and before he knew it, he was at the gym regularly. So I want to encourage you to do something really simple. Something that's impossible to fail at, and that is to buy a domain for something that you're thinking about, something maybe crazy, and it might actually lead you to actually launching your crazy idea or big dream. And our friends at HostGator can help you get started because they'll give you 33% off all their hosting packages. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off. Michael, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this conversation with you.
Yeah, me too. So, you know, it's funny. I was texting my business partner, Brian. I said, you know, this is like getting to have a conversation with the performance coach from the TV show Billions, which is, you know, kind of what really drew me into your work was that. And then, of course, Liz Wiseman, who was a former guest here, had mentioned your name to me. And when I got to look at what you did around peak performance psychology, I thought, yeah, this is a crazy story that we have to tell. But before we get there, I want to start with a question that has been really a lot of fun and really interesting to see kind of where it's going and how it's impacted people. What social group were you a part of in high school? What did you learn from being part of that social group? And how did that impact the choices that you ended up making with your life and your career?
So let's start at the beginning. In high school, so there was a little bit of a windy path to get to the group that I got to in high school. And so right before high school, it's actually something that I think will set up this story properly. I moved a bunch. My folks were in corporate America, and so I bounced around a little bit as my dad's roles expanded and grew, and he was on that arc in his career. And so I found action sports. And action sports and adventure sports were I was drawn to because there was risk involved, there was challenge involved, and there were no traditional coaches. And so I learned much from Mother Nature, and then that working out that little dialogue in my head between hesitation and commitment. And so I found myself in high school attracted to the same types of people. And I grew up in Southern California, so surfing was the group that I spent most of my time with.
Interesting. As an avid surfer, I can appreciate that more than you possibly imagine.
Perfect.
So I have a question about that because, you know, I'm one of those people who started surfing when I was in 30, and I was a band geek in high school, like the least imaginable person that would be drawn to action sports of all things. Because, as you know, action sports basically involve no traditional coaches, a lot of getting your ass handed to you, especially as a surfer. I'm curious, what do you think it is that enables that kind of switch to happen for somebody later in life?
Well, I think, you know, it's a really thoughtful question because as we get older, hopefully we're still growing. And some people, they foreclose on their identity at an early age and they miss the importance of accelerated growth. Mm-hmm. And so, but however, if you have demonstrations of what you just talked about, likely what took place is that your palate changed, your palate for information, your hunger for experience in different avenues to touch different parts of your mind, your body, your soul, whatever it might be. And so it's just a great demonstration of people that are wanting to grow.
Do you think that that palate change of sorts is something that can be deliberately engineered and brought about in your lives? And if so, how?
Yeah, I don't think that it's like that deliberate. I think that, yeah, there are, you know, I'm cautious to say there's two types of people, but there are some very noticeable trends for people is that some folks are deeply engaged in wanting to grow. And you can be, when you're around them, you notice because they're all in. And they're hungry to learn. They're applying what they've learned. They're doing something with what they just learned. They're adding it to their scaffolding in a way that is not just taking information to make it work for them, but they're figuring out how it works for their psychological framework. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can just make a decision like I want to be like that. I think, of course, all things in my mind do start with decisions that are kind of that correlate and swim together with our genetic coding, but it's not quite as clean because it goes from decision-making to action to habit, you know, to testing that habit in progressively intense environments is kind of the clip that allows people to be able to stand in their own 2 feet and say, you know, this is what I've learned and not be afraid of what other people think of that journey. Mm.
So I'm curious, as a surfer, what are the life lessons that you have carried into other areas of your life and into the work that you do from your experience in the water? And of course, you know, because so much of what I do is driven by, you know, the time that I spend in the water. I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah. Really? Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's really cool. First of all, like when I hear the phrase as a surfer, I remember in high school never wanting to be part of that phrase. And I spent my whole life in the water, really. Yeah. Like it was tough to get through high school, like the academic part, because of the amount of time I spent in the water. But I remember at that age, there was two magazines, Surfing and Surfer. Okay. And I thought, no, that I'm not going to be identified of just being a surfer. And so when I hear you say it now, it goes back to high school. Like, no, you know what? We're not defined by just that little thing that we do or that we love, but there's so much more that we incorporate that which we love into other parts of our environment. So the answer, that's like the long part of the question, but the shorter part is the space between hesitation and commitment and working out that small little seemingly instantaneous experience that is part of the risk-taking process. And that Mother Nature and progression of skill has taught me much about how the mind works. And then, you know, through my academic career, I've been able to sort out all the theories that were related to it and all the bright men and women that have studied that. And then my applied experiences in life have, you know, I've just been able to acid test those thoughts with some of the most exceptional performers in the world. So it's like, I think that that's it. It's working out risk and what it means to be able to go for it and how important our psychological framework and that little dialogue in our head. those are some of the things that I'm just so fortunate to learn from my community and Mother Nature.
Okay, so I want to get into your academic career and kind of how, you know, it led to where you're at.
Boring.
Well, one of the other questions I have, you know, I had a guy named Chris Redlitz here who's a venture capitalist who teaches prisoners how to code and is starting a tech incubator in San Quentin. And, you know, we were talking about immersive experiences. Like, he had spent a year as a ski bum. And he credits that to being one of the most influential experiences of his life in terms of how he built businesses because he understood at a certain level what true immersion and true commitment actually felt like. And, you know, I mean, I'm one of those late bloomer surfers who, you know, spent 6 hours a day for 6 months straight in the water because I was unemployed. And so, you know, I got this very immersive experience that you don't really get to have in adult life. And so I'm curious, one, you know, based on the work that you've done with the people that you've worked with, do you find that these kinds of immersive experiences are necessary for us to achieve peak performance and perform at the highest levels, regardless of what it is we're doing? And if we don't have those immersive experiences, how can we bring the elements that we might learn from an immersive experience into our lives and our work?
Yeah, good. So first, I'm not really interested in peak performance. And because peak means like there's a summit and then there's a decline. And so I see it more like a progression, and hopefully a life progression of figuring out a craft, figuring out our body, and figuring out our mind. And if all three, if we can wrap all three together in progression, then that's pretty cool. So I'm not interested in peak performance as just, you know, first thought. So, but not to screw up your question on that idea, is like if we replace the word peak with progression or sustainable or high performance, something along those range without being too ivory tower about it, that, you know, I think that what we end up doing is immersing, when we immerse ourselves in an environment, we learn so much because it is part and parcel of what we're thinking about and doing most often throughout the day. So most people on the world stage are deeply and richly invested in something for an extended period of time every day. And that goes back to some classic research from, early in, I think late in the 1980s about immersion and deliberate practice. And so that idea is hard to escape. If you want to become and pursue, I was going to say become great, but it's really about pursuing your potential. You got to be saturated with that which you care most about.
All right. So like I said, I want to do a deep dive into all of this stuff. But before we get there, walk me through from being a surfer in high school to how you become the person that you are today. Like where, what in the world led you down this trajectory? Because it's, being a performance psychologist is usually not one of the options that's put in front of you when you're in school.
Yeah, okay, very cool. So thanks for teeing that up. When I was in high school, no one in my family went to college. And, you know, they're more entrepreneurial, and corporate America was the function. So I didn't have a model of university settings. And so in high school, I was just really soaking up the experience. And I was immersed as much as I possibly could in the things that I loved, and school was not one of them. So I got to the end of school, high school, and my parents pulled me aside and they're like, you know, we tried, son. We didn't know exactly how to guide you right. We never went that path. We tried. So you've got two options. You can get a job and get out, or you can go to community college and then you could still live here. And there was this blank look on my face. And my mom, I remember clearly my mom in our kitchen looking at me saying, did you really think that you were just going to live here and surf the rest of your life? And so I was embarrassed. I was kind of like, yeah, that's the kind of the plan. It's working so far. So I wasn't ready to get a job and get out. I was, you know, I was young. I was 17 when I graduated high school. And so I knew I could surf a lot and go to school. So I went to community college. And there was two community colleges in our area. One was a private and one was public. And the private one was right on top of a great surf break. So you know which one I chose. And then what ended up happening is there was three professors, Dr. Cusio, Dr. Zenka, and Dr. Perkins. I love saying their name out loud. Hopefully, you know, they're listening and I, you know, hey guys, how you doing? And so they were, the three of them together were good buds. And they were a philosopher. They were, each one was a philosopher. Another one was a psychologist and another was a theologian. And I fell in love with learning. And learning the invisible, and they just had a way about introducing I don't want to say magic, that's not right, just a way of thinking about the things that we cannot see but we know that are real. And no one ever asked me to read from that book, from that point forward, another book. Like I just wanted to learn more. And so it just took fire, and I get asked probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 10 emails a week about, you know, how can I get into the career? I want to do what you're doing. You know, can you give me any advice? And I want to work with pro athletes. And I just stopped the conversation there saying, it's not, who cares about working with, you know, the best in the world? Like, you got to figure out how, what lights you up. And when that takes place, you'll find the right path for you, whatever that might be. And so that's maybe a longer way of thinking about how that happened for me.
Interesting. So several questions come from that. You know, it's interesting that, you know, when you were only given two options, you went with one. I'm curious why you think that we are so conditioned to choose solely from the options that are put in front of us. And when options aren't put in front of us, I mean, in your case, you thrived when options weren't put in front of you, which is really kind of an interesting case study in my mind. So I'm just curious kind of what your thoughts are on all of that.
Yeah, I think that had to do with like my sophistication and my inner courage. And as a young kid, I knew I could have gone a third option, which was travel the world and surf. And I could have figured that out. However, I just wasn't quite ready to make that step. And I knew that I didn't have a gap, a treasure chest between the gap of the money I had now and my ability to kind of figure out where to live. And so it just seemed like the step I took was the next natural progression. It just made sense that, oh, well, I know how to do A and B, which was school and surf, so let me continue that. And I didn't think I was going to care a minute about school. I had no interest in it. It was so I could surf more and so that I could figure out the gap between traveling the world and figuring out how to surf for a living. And something else took hold. So it wasn't like there was this third imaginary thing that I wanted. This was the next natural step.
It's so funny to hear you say that, because the parallels between how I've ended up doing this and writing books are so similar. Like, everything that I wanted to do, I told a friend, I said, you know, I have to be honest, I'm like, the sole motivation behind everything that I've built was just so I could surf more. But it led to all these other things that you would have never predicted as byproducts.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. And I think that that's a really cool way to think about, as all of us, we are co-creators in our life. And some of you might want to think that we're creators, and that's fine too. But I see it as like we're co-creators. And you know, there's lots of co inside of that, our genetic coding, our spiritual framework, if you believe in that or have one, and then the people and environments that we operate in. And all of those, in my mind, are co-shaping and creating the design of our life. So, and I don't want to be esoteric by any means, but we're not in a vacuum. And just because we make a decision doesn't mean it's so. You know, there's lots of forms and functions around us that are supporting and challenging us towards that aim. For example, I could say I want to be the greatest sumo wrestler in the world, but my frame is not designed that way. My genetic coding is not designed that way. So I need to kind of play nicely and intelligently within my environment, my genetic coding, my mind, and the people that I spend my time with. So it's beautiful to think about setting your sights on something you want to experience. And it's really important, I think, is when you set those sights, to have real clarity about what are the things that are in your control and what are the things you're going to go along for the ride with, and what are the things you're going to influence on that path. Mm.
So before we start doing a dive into performance and high-stakes situations, I want to ask you one other question about the academic period. You mentioned that these three professors were, you know, involved in philosophy, psychology, and theology. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how each one of those three disciplines has made its way into your work today and what you've taken from those.
I love it. They're all intertwined. So the psychology piece was obviously, for me, I gravitated more towards that. And I'll tell another story about that in a minute if you want. But the theology part is more a placeholder for the spiritual side of life. Like, what are we doing here? Is there a spiritual question, or is there a spiritual quest or not? And then the philosophy is like asking those really difficult questions about the larger nature of the world. And so the mind is more singular focused, like how do I train or become aware of my mind's activity now? And that's very different to me than cognitive functioning. So cognitive functioning is kind of like that, the closer knit between the brain and the mind. And then the mind is more about, the thoughts that are guiding our decisions or us becoming more aware of our thoughts. And then the brain is more of that neural kind of 3 pounds of silly putty in our brain. And so let me stitch it together. The mind is more narrow focused. Philosophy for me is more broadly focused about the human condition. And then theology is just that connection between like that spiritual or soulful piece of being a human. And I love all three. And I'm not sure clearly how to separate them. I know the disciplines do a good job of it. But, you know, that idea that mind and body, as Descartes said long ago, is are separate. They're just not. You know, it's like there's no chance that that we're going to be able to accept that thought nowadays. So they're all intertwined, and those are the things I think about most. Hmm.
Well, I think this is a perfect transition to start getting really deep into your actual work. You know, where I want to start with this is when an athlete comes to you, why is it that they're specifically coming to you? What are they hoping to accomplish, and what do you do with them? that, you know, really we could extract at sort of a layer that is applicable to anybody's life?
Yeah, most of them are already exceptional at what they do. And what they're looking to do is they know they have more inside. They want to explore that potential. They want to go further. They want to sustain it. They want to understand how to make that experience of them being completely on point and fluid and in the pocket. They want to be able to know the mechanics to experience that more often. And so that's it. It's I would say, I don't want to say never, but rarely is it somebody that comes knocking on the door that says, "Hey, I'm really screwed up." You know, these are people that are exceptional at what they do, and they are nuanced and sophisticated, and they're hungry. Mm-hmm. And so this idea to help people, like in an airport, or I've just stopped having those conversations on the airport because most of the conversations are, "Oh, so you do motivational speaking." And I just want to kind of throw up on my hands. Like, that's, it's so far from what I've come to learn from some of the best in the world, is that they don't need motivation. Yeah. They're exceptional at what they do, and they're hungry to go the distance of what they've been able to experience glimpses of in the past.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by The Great Courses Plus. Like many of you, my love of learning didn't stop when I finished school, and that's because it's been driven by curiosity as opposed to things that I was being forced to learn, so that way I've read way more books and taken many more courses than I actually did in school. And that's why I'm super excited about the new The Great Courses Plus video learning service. You can learn about anything that interests you with unlimited access to thousands of The Great Courses lecture series on a bunch of fascinating topics taught by a number of top professors. And we really want you to try out The Great Courses Plus, so they're giving our listeners a special chance to watch hundreds of their courses completely for free, including the course that I've been watching called The Creative Thinker's Toolkit. And this toolkit is taught by Professor Gerard Puccio, and it's a fascinating step-by-step guide through the four stages of the creative thinking process. And it's really, really cool because it offers you practical application and insights and exercises you can do after each lecture. If you have kids, it's filled with great insights on how to make them more creative. You'll even learn about the science of how your brain works and how you can leverage that to come up with new creative ideas. The quality of the content is phenomenal. And with the variable speed feature on your mobile device, you can watch one lecture in just 15 minutes a day, so you can, you know, learn something new every single day. And not only that, with The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere. And they're giving us a special offer specifically for Unmistakable Creative listeners, and I know you'll love The Great Courses Plus like I do. So sign up today, and as one of our podcast listeners, you'll get 1 month immediately free to start watching as many lectures as you want. So make sure to check out the course I watched first, The Creative Thinker's Toolkit. And to get started and to start your free trial today, sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/creative. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/creative. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Design Crowd. So one of the things that I think is really important is that you understand what an impression design makes. In fact, design is the first impression that people have of your work. So if it's not visually appealing, it's kind of hard for them to take your work seriously. And most of us think design has to be this incredibly complicated, incredibly expensive thing that's only accessible to people with millions of dollars. Well, fortunately, that's where a service like Design Crowd comes in, because they make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's affordable to anyone. No matter what it is that you want to design, whether it's books, whether it's flyers, whether it's websites, whether it's business cards, t-shirts, posters, people on Design Crowd can help you do that. And here's how it works. You submit your project, whatever it might be, and you'll get up to 60 to 100 submissions over the course of a couple of days. And if you like what you see, you can approve payment. If not, you can actually go back to the crowd and you can ask for more submissions, or you can get your money back. You know, as I've said before, you don't want to do things that are out of your zone of genius. And if you're not a designer, spending time on design is actually a real waste of time when you could be doing much more high quality work. So not only that, for being an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting $100 off your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative. All right. So that raises several questions, as you might imagine. One of the questions that keeps coming up in my mind is why we see this tremendous gap between what people are capable of, like what their potential is and where they're actually at, and what accounts for that gap in people, and what have you seen as the difference between those types of people and the ones that you work with?
I wish that this thought could be more pervasive for more people, is that there is so much more to go.
Yeah.
And what we are capable of is so rich. And I just wish that thought could be more pervasive, because I think that it is a thought that gets in the way, which is, I'm not sure what I want to do, and I'm not sure if I did make up my mind that I could do it. And what ends up happening for those that are exceptional is that somehow they've chipped in. And it might be before they could actually make an informed decision because their parents and their environment were supporting them to go for it. But they really did chip in, and there's a lot on the line. And so I think your question was also about, like, how can we, what are some of the ways that people that do go for it, how they're different? Was that part of the question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely, when we study people that are exceptional at risk taking, there's some clear functions that are, you know, take part. And one of those is that there's a phrase that guides many of them. I'm sorry, there's two phrases that guide many of them. One is, you'll do whatever it takes. When something matters to you, you'll do whatever it takes. And if you think about being a mother or a husband or a father or, you know, someone that you deeply love in your family structure and there's a car coming, you would do whatever it took to be able to save that person that you love. And so that level of conviction starts with great clarity. And that clarity is the statement that I love you to as much as you can articulate in words. And I will do in my action whatever it takes. So that doesn't mean that essence of the love of what I'm just describing now, that I've aligned with clarity my thoughts of what's important, and to do that with the action, that happens at home every day in, you know, millions of homes across the world. And it also happens in business. Those that care deeply about the businesses that they're part of. And it also happens in entrepreneurship, and it happens in craft development. You'll do whatever it takes. And that clarity to conviction is a really important process to go for. So that's one. And the second that I see as a defining characteristic is that there's incredible pain for those that have the clarity but lack the conviction when they get tested. And so imagine at home, if you love that person so much and they consume so much of your heart or your body with love, and then you freeze when they are being embarrassed or they're in physical harm's way. And there's so much pain for those that are that we're talking about that become exceptional, that pain is the impetus to do the training. And so here's another story that I'll share with you to kind of harden that up just a little bit, is that I was fortunate enough to work with people at the highest level of action and adventure sports. And that was with at some time I spent with Red Bull North America to be able to work with that high performance program as well as the athletes that Red Bull sponsors. And so what they've taught me is that it's much more painful to have an idea and to not go for that idea because of fear than it is to go for it and get bruised, scraped, or even, you know, kill themselves in the process, which is hard to say out loud because that's a real possibility for people that are on the edge, whether it's financial or otherwise. And so this is a longer way of saying mastering the risk-taking process. And the second is putting in the work, because the pain of not being able to go for it is so great that you do whatever it takes to be able to master that process so that you're not stuck being passive or small in the moments of test.
Mm. Wow. So I have a question just based on personal experience. I'm curious, based on your work and kind of the things you've done, what role are mental health and mental wellness, you know, dealing with things like anxiety, depression, like what role does all of that play in all of this? And, you know, in some cases I found that often, you know, you look at entrepreneurial success and, you know, mental anxiety and craziness almost go hand in hand.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, there's an old saying in high performance, like physical training, or like on the world stage with people that are exceptional in the physical training domain, is that they say that performance, physical health stops where true performance begins. And so I don't think that I agree with that. I haven't seen any research or evidence that would suggest otherwise, meaning that those that are exceptional are mentally unhealthy.
Sure.
So I haven't seen that in research. So everything that I will talk about or I'm fascinated by goes through two filters. And and neither of them are a bullshit filter. The first is really, science. And then the second is, does this stuff play right with people that are already on the world stage and exceptional? And so here's what I would say is that for those to stay the distance and to do difficult things and boring things for an extended period of time because they have a love to figure out their potential and they've tasted the pain of not being able to meet the demands of a test, whatever that test is, spiritually, physically, craft-wise, mentally, whatever it is that there is maybe a little bit more anxiousness, but I wouldn't say it's clinically diagnosed as they have a general anxiety disorder or they have OCD, but there is just a little bit of anxiousness. There is a little bit of OCD, or call it perfectionism, but that becomes at some point, both of those become traps towards like this undulation to sustaining their potential, because OCD and needing things to be just right to be okay internally is an exhaustive experience. And in that exhaustive experience, if we're constantly trying to control and manage our world in ways that don't make any sense, and people with OCD say it doesn't make any sense to me, mm-hmm. it's so noisy that it ends up being a cost to investing on the things that we can potentially control 100% of the time. And so that's a lot of what I'm saying right now is that those that are on the path of mastery and those that are truly investing their life efforts to understand the nuances of craft is that they're really clear that mastery is about controlling what's in their control exceptionally well and doing it in varied environments. So I don't think that mental health and sustaining excellence on the world stage are at opposite ends.
Sure, yeah. And I don't think I meant that by saying that.
It
might have come out that way, but I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that like if we think about, you know, more severe mental illness, that there's, I don't know, like narcissism and there's certainly narcissistic people in every walk of life. But it makes sense that some narcissism would be part of people that like the spotlight on them, you know, and where most of us would have some sort of anxiousness about what others might think early in our career or early in that idea that people are watching what we're doing. But the narcissists don't have that struggle at all. Yeah. And so there's different costs to the narcissist in professional sports or professional arenas. There's just a different cost. It doesn't mean that there's more or less, but it might make sense that we would see some of those traits at a lower level across more people.
Why do you think that some people experience post-traumatic growth and others experience post-traumatic stress? And have you seen that in the people that you work mm-hmm. with? Like, and what have been the patterns there?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, I'm sure that you and your listeners have talked a lot about that because that's a really cool question. And so,
that's why I asked it.
Yeah, we don't know. The answer in the field and through science is we don't exactly know. There is a rich investigation around neurotransmitters and genetic predisposition for both of those functions. And what we do know, though, is that much of what will influence people to go down something that's heavy and either they've witnessed something that is life-altering or they've experienced something that's life-altering, for them to move down the path of growth is that we want to get more connected to the way that they're framing up that experience. And a lot of times the way we frame an experience is based on the reality of our genetic coding. So neuropeptide Y is a neuropeptide that we see people that do exceptional in special in war times when they have high neuropeptide Y, but they take greater risks and they end up dying a bit earlier than those that don't. So it's not a simple answer and it's complicated. We don't know completely, but we do have some sense that when you just pose the option, hey, you know, some people go through heavy experiences and it becomes a PTSD, and some people go through heavy experiences and they end up becoming stronger through it. And then there's a dialogue that would ensue from that to help people shape up, how to see it as a growth opportunity. So how do we do that? One is know that that's an option. Two is build the stuff of resiliency and hardiness. And then, you know, be aware of that inner dialogue and our response to unconscious or non-conscious stress so that we can catch that train of thought or that stress response earlier on the train track than later. Because when we're flooded with neurochemicals and we're flooded with experience internally, and meaning our body and our thoughts, and it feels overwhelming, it's really hard to adjust and be fluid. But if we can catch it through training our awareness of our body and or our mind earlier on that train, if you will, then it's easier to course correct and adjust. So, those are at least four different ways that we think about the difference between the two.
So I have a question on resilience. I dedicated an entire chapter in my book titled fittingly, The Impact Zone to resilience, because this is a question that I've asked a handful of people. I keep wondering whether the resilience that you gain from what I define as impact zone moments can only be, gained by going through those experiences. Like, it just seems to me in so many cases that you can't get that without having experienced the thing that you have to go through to get it. Does that make any sense?
Say it to me again.
So basically, let's use the impact zone as a metaphor, which you're familiar with. And for anybody who doesn't surf, I've mentioned this before, the impact zone is when you're basically in the wrong place at the wrong time, getting hit by wave after wave after wave on the head, and it seems like it's never going to end, and you're never going to get back up to the lineup where you actually catch waves and surf. And in our lives, that's when just horrible shit keeps happening to us over and over and over again. And, one of the things I said is the only thing in my mind that can prepare you for that is the experience of going through it so that the next time you're there, you know how to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, okay. Gotcha.
I'm curious what your perspective is on all of this.
Well, yeah, resiliency is that thing that, is so admirable when we watch it. It looks like somebody just has the ability to deal with difficult things, and they looked poised maybe during the times that some of us would say, God, how do they do that? And it's because you can't develop resiliency and or poise without going through difficult things. And that's the first. And so if you want to do challenging things in life, which I think most people say, yeah, I want to get after it. Like, I really want to have an amazing life. And there's a challenge embedded in that. To have that be a reality, it means that we're going to do difficult things. And if we want to have a wonderful life, and we're saying that inside of that there's going to be challenges, then as soon as we're in the challenges, we can love it. Like, that's what we've set out to do. So that's the first part, is like getting ahead of it. And the second part is that when you're in the soup of it and it's difficult and it's challenging and there's a struggle mentally or physically, there's too much tension to be fluid, then, we do everything we can to kind of survive at that moment. And that's, sometimes that's okay, because it's good information that we don't have the physical, technical, or mental skills to be able to deal with whatever impact zone that we're talking about. All that being said is that once we go through things that are difficult and we want to stay and build resiliency, the research around the three C's is pretty clear, is that we need challenging situations, we need to be able to commit to having a kick-ass mindset when we're in it, and then being able to have a sense of control in our lives that we actually do dictate our own experience. And those three C's have been some research that has been, I think wonderful. And anyone that wants to look that up, it's Kobasa, 1979, would be the origins of that research. Hmm.
All right, so since we're talking about high-stakes situations, I can't help but ask you about the Golden State Warriors and kind of, what we've seen from Steph Curry and the fact that, they come back from this crazy sort of, being down in the semifinals and also just killing it in the finals. So I'm curious, what is it that accounts for people's ability to perform at the highest levels in high-stakes situations? Given the work that you've done and, through the lens of what we're seeing with the Warriors at the moment?
Well, let's go in reverse order. Okay. What are the capabilities? And the first is being fully present. And because if we're not fully present and we haven't trained our mind to do so, then we find ourselves having one eye on the ball, so to speak, and one eye worrying about what's coming next, or one eye worrying on what happened last play or last moment. So it's having both eyes into the experience wherever one's feet are. And so literally it's a mental skill to be where your feet are. And that is, in the present moment, is where excellence happens. And, so that's the number one skill to work on. And what ends up happening is that if we think of this trajectory of performance, hierarchy of performance, is that we've got choking at the bottom. We've got micro choking, which is just a little bit better. Then we've got performing. And then above that, we've got performing under pressure. And then above that, we have thriving under pressure. And then above that, we have dissolving pressure. And so it is possible to dissolve pressure. And if we can work from that framework, then, you know, the stakes of the environment fade away. And let's also be reminded that whatever we're watching on TV, when there's an organized sport involved, the stakes are not the stakes of war and the stakes of extreme poverty. You know, so it's a game, and no one's dying, right? Some people might lose a lot of money or reputation if the NBA doesn't go, an NBA game doesn't go quite right. But there's, when I think of stakes, I think of life is on the line as the ultimate stakes. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a wonderful space that we can create for all of us, you know, you and I included in this, is that, you know, public speaking tends to be so freaking hard for people. It's because they perceive the stakes to be so high. But what is at risk there is what another person might be thinking of you. And if you can undo that by being able to have a framework that says, listen, I have something I want to say, and I'm honored that I have people that will I have attended to be able to care. And so then if you can come from like a sense of value, like I have something I really want to share with you, and I'm grateful for you to be here, the whole thing changes, because it's impossible to have two thoughts at the same time, two emotions at the same time. That's not how our body works. If we only get one thought at a time and one emotion at a time, we dictate that, you know, and that's the beauty of having awareness of your thoughts and having the mental skill to be able to control thoughts. And so you can go back to surfing, and, you know, but everybody has their surfing. Everybody has those moments where they're like, holy shit, like I'm about to get tested here. I'm above my pay grade. I'm not sure what to do here. This is scary. I'm not well equipped. And that type of experience is so rewarding to build capacity. And it's so uncomfortable, though, that so many of us move away from those experiences because of that uncomfortable and that risk experience. So it's a long way of saying embrace those things that are challenging, learn on how your natural response is from a mental standpoint, become aware of how you'd like to be in the present moment, and then adjust accordingly through mental training.
Hmm. And what about the Warriors?
Yeah. Okay, so going back, like the stakes of that is that the NBA, the stakes, what's at stake? It's reputation, it is loss, and financial. And so how have they done it? I don't know how particularly they've done it, but it seems as though that they've created space to play freely. And one of the ways to create that space to play freely is to be very clear that we are at our best when we're helping others, and we are at our best when we're not consumed about what could go wrong. And both of those are part of the inner game, the mental game, if you will.
Yeah. Okay, so...
You know what? Let me add just one more thing, absolutely, really quickly. Is that if we're not careful, all of this can just sound like rhetoric.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to talk about things, like be focused, be confident, be aware. However, there's like 2, 3, 4 layers underneath of that about how to train that, how to actually spend the time to train one's mind. And that's a whole different level.
Yeah.
And without the actual, and I mean it, like rigorous training schedule, just like we would train our craft or our body, it becomes rhetoric, and it just becomes this cliche kind of conversation that we have. And so I just want to make sure that we honor that those that demonstrate exceptional and continuous growth in their craft, they're doing something to train their mind. And it's likely not by chance. It's likely that they've studied it. They've been around people that have shown them how to do it. And nowadays, it's really fun because those teachers tend to be leveraging great science. And that's the science of, you know, psychology, which is just a wonderful, exploding, exciting science and application of science time right now. So it's a great time to really learn those 2, 3, 4 levels underneath of the doing, and not just the rhetoric of talking about it.
Hmm. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Chapman University. Chapman's located in Orange County, California, just 16 miles from the beach and a little over 30 miles from LA. They have about 8,000 students enrolled in undergraduate and graduate programs, so the classes are small and the student to faculty ratio is 14 to 1, so you get a ton of personalized attention. And what they're best known for are their programs in film, television, business, science and technology, education, health sciences, and the arts. So with 10 different schools and colleges and more than 100 different majors and programs, there's literally something for everyone. And if you're wondering what there is to do in free time, a ton, because they have over 200 student clubs and organizations. If you're interested in studying abroad, they have dozens of opportunities to do that, whether you're looking to do a short trip or whether you're looking to do an entire semester. And here's the best part. 86% of the students benefit from some sort of financial aid, so you may not have to pay for all this yourself. So whether you're looking to go back to school or maybe you have a student who's looking at colleges, visit chapman.edu/information. Again, that's chapman.edu/information. This episode is also sponsored by HostGator. So I told you about HostGator at the beginning of the episode, and I hope you'll really consider buying a domain and starting a project. If nothing else, what I would tell you to do is just buy your name as a domain so that you don't end up having to spend $1,000 just to buy yourname.com, like my business partner Brian is probably going to have to at some point. And not only that, they provide 30% off for all Unmistakable Creative listeners. All you have to do is go to hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. And last but not least, TrueCar. So if you haven't downloaded this app yet or been to their website, you should definitely check it out because it's super cool. And there's something that you might not know is that whether you're looking for a new or used car, you can actually use TrueCar to buy a car. So if you download the app, you'll see you can actually set the make, the model, the features, everything with just the push of a few buttons. And then you can actually see pictures of the car, even if you want to see the interior. You can see the price that you'll likely pay along with the discount that you get, and you'll be able to use it to connect with a local certified dealer. There have been over 500,000 pre-owned cars that are available on TrueCar. Not only that, over 2 million cars have been sold and 11,000 nationwide dealers use TrueCar. And TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off MSRP. So check it out if you haven't yet. So whether you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. And some features are not available in all states. Well, you know what question that's going to raise from people is what can be done in their own lives, maybe day to day, to start training this aspect of their minds?
Well, the first part is awareness. Like to you know, the beginning and the end is really going to come to the function of how aware we are of ourselves, our thoughts, our emotions, our body, and the unfolding world around us. And that really, to say a word in a trite way, but that really begins with mindfulness and a mindfulness practice to be able to become more aware of those things so that we can develop greater insight and awareness. And the two of those together are how we train. So what does that look like? Clear the stage, clear the theater in one's mind so that we can see what wants to naturally populate the theater. And I don't know a better way to do that than writing and or observing one's thoughts. And so it's one of those two ways that seem to really be a well-tested, both from a scientific and an ancient appreciation for how to become more aware of one's thoughts. Mm.
So I want to ask you two questions that my business partner, Brian, said he wanted to know about since he knew I was talking to you. The first is, how do you balance your training and intuition without getting stuck in either when you're in a high-stakes situation?
Well, when you're in a high-stakes situation, that's not the training. It's not the time for training. The training is before it. And so when you're in a moment of test or you're in a moment where, you know, there is something that is of consequence. And in surfing, you know this. We talk about waves of consequence.
Yeah.
And that's not to be said lightly. And, you know, a wave of consequence means just that something could go so horribly wrong that it could be one of your last. And most waves in surfing are nowhere near a wave of consequence, you know. So just out of respect for what some of these men and women are doing nowadays. So the training comes before the test. And again, that training is mindfulness. It's awareness of self-talk. It is breathing work. It is writing to get more clear about the thoughts that you'd want to have. And then the second is when you're in a moment, whatever moment we're talking about, consequence or not, is that it is a complete availability between intuition and skill. And so when you blend skill with intuition, you got something really special. And if you've got the intuition or the instincts or whatever word we talk about to respond accordingly to a moment, but you don't have the skill either to do it once or 100 times if you're in an environment that is perpetual, then you come short. And so you come up short. So when we are completely clear in our mind, we are available for information that seems intuitive or automatic. But somehow that intuition, it's been programmed. It's been programmed by watching or observing or doing the craft that we're talking about being able to execute, whether that's conversation and picking up micro expressions or body language, or that's surfing, or that's entrepreneurship and creating ideas based on previous frames that you've heard others talk about or you've been part of, so that you can adjust accordingly. So your partner's right on the money is to be able to listen to your intuition and have the skill to back it up is the whole inner game. And how do you pay attention to more intuition? That's awareness.
All right, so one other question from him, and then we'll start wrapping things up. One of the things he asked is, how do you regain your composure without making it obvious that you're feeling thrown off in a situation like this?
What does that mean? That's a cool question. I'm not sure what that means. How do you regain
composure? So I guess, you know, the thing is, there are certain moments in our lives, you know, it could be, for example, let's say you're standing on stage and you go blank, which has been known to happen to people. Even Simon Sinek, who's like one of the best keynote speakers in the world, said in a course that he's lost his train of thought in the middle of a talk before. So maybe that's one of them. So I guess let's use that as an example, since that kind of is a way of saying, okay, my composure has been thrown off in what is a semi-high stakes situation.
Yeah, I think that that there's no one response to that. Yeah. And I haven't seen any research on it, so I won't speak from a research frame. And maybe there is, and I'd love to read it if some of your listeners are keyed up on that. But I think my experience when I hear people talk about it, and I use myself as an N of one, is that just keep going. And there's an old saying, you know, in dance and theater acting, is that the show must go on. So just keep going. Like, right, that just seems to be an old adage that makes clear sense. And then the second is, sometimes it's eloquent to say, hey, everyone, I've lost my train of thought. And can you help me remind me? Be a human, yeah. Right? We're not made to be perfect. We're made to be fluid and have eloquence and adjust. So I can't say that there's one way, but I do know that, like, you know, the full panic and the sheer panic of not being perfect tends to be more damaging to people's ability to go for it than the actual experience of not, you know, knowing what to think or do just in the right way. So, you know, it's, and again, like, if you have a keynote address, and if that's what we're talking about in this case with Simon, you know, most keynotes are like 15 minutes to 45 to 90 minutes, somewhere in that range. There's time, you know, and like, it's a living, breathing experience in exchange between two people. There are experiences, though, when it's finite, it's yes, it's no, it's binary. And if you make a mistake, it's over. And you want to train your ass off before those types of experiences so that the hesitation and blank slate, if you will, is the likelihood of blanking out would be really low.
All right. So one last question before the last question. So two more questions. This has been really an interesting, question that has led to a lot of interesting insights. What's one piece of art, book, music, or movie that has profoundly influenced your life that you'd recommend to our audience?
Well, so I grew up in the 80s, and one of the ones that was just really wonderful for me was Star Wars. And I remember at a really young age, I was like 7 or 8 years old, and watching that going, oh my God, there's good and evil. It's like at play. And just kind of the tension between, doing right and the power that can come from doing wrong. And, you know, that has just been a fun little thing that's been in the back of my mind for a long time. But if we look at kind of more modern times. I think that Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl was a game changer. And certainly the first half of that book is something that I would recommend that most people read. And so I would start there. And then I would start with, if you want to go a little further than that, I would say that who shapes the culture and thoughts more than world religions? So certainly picking up the Quran, picking up Tao Te Ching, picking up the Bible, picking up, and these are not easy reads, but I think in our lives we should read read each one of those books at least once, you know, understanding the Eight Path Fold from the Buddhist perspective, there's incredibly robust and sturdy practices that world religions have helped to generate. And so there's something important there. And then I would also recommend that any distilled book on mindset training from a really well-respected authors, there'd be something there that we want to pay attention to as well.
Hmm. All right. So one last question before we wrap things up, which is how we close all our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's being authentic and expressing honestly who a person is. So it's understanding deeply who a person is, and then having the courage and the skill and the conviction to have that alignment between thoughts, words, and actions in any and every environment. And so it's a true expression of oneself. And if we can do that artistically, I think that that is really cool. And but to be really succinct, it's the alignment between thoughts, words, and actions, and doing that in any and every environment.
Awesome. Well, this has just been epic. Like, so many cool insights. This is, you know, one of those conversations I know I'm going to probably have to play back 100 times, just because you packed it with so much value. And I
thought we were going to talk more about surfing. Seriously, I didn't know we're going to get into the heavy stuff, but yeah. Always fun to talk about the heavy stuff. I appreciate, you know, the time to have this conversation. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you more about what you're doing. Like, what you've created as a platform is beautiful. So I enjoy it as well.
Thank you. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
I would say the simplest way to develop a sense of fearlessness in life is to take on the theme of, I'm going to do it anyway, right? And to start small. You know, it's like, in my mind, it's like lifting weights like anything else. You know, maybe I'm a little intimidated to go to a party, right? Maybe I tend to like to be by myself more, something like this. And it could be such an easy or simple small step, or it could appear simple and easy to other people, but maybe it's something that creates anxiety or produces a sense of uncertainty within us. And so just start taking, it's like taking those small steps and going, you know, yes, I'm afraid. Yes, I feel anxiety here. And you know what? I'm going to do it anyway.
Joey Klein joins us to discuss conscious transformation.